Hello and welcome to the audio transcription of the back page.
The Talking Sports newspaper.
Dated the 6th to the 12th of February 2019. Produced by Vista. Telephone 0116 249 8839. Items are selected, read and recorded by the Gartry Audio Services team. The team members this week are
Andrew,
Daniel,
Jeff,
Lee,
Malcolm
and Marcel.
City news.
Breathtaking. Leicester City's new training ground will be the most advanced in Europe, say the engineering specialists hired to oversee the £100 million project. Manchester-based TRP Consulting will be in charge of the development of City's state-of-the-art training facility in Charnwood, based at the 185-acre former Park Hill Golf Club site off the A46. The plans include 12 full-size pitches, together with various smaller pitches and outdoor training areas, plus a full-size indoor pitch with a signature central building. The plans were drawn up by KSS Architects, who planned Tottenham Hotspur's training ground and Liverpool's new main stand developments, as well as number one court at Wimbledon and Twickenham's east stand. TRP Director Jeff Wilkes said, "The city plans were breathtaking. This is a fantastic sporting facility that is being described as the most advanced in Europe," he told Insider Media Limited. "We're delighted to have been appointed to work with KSS, one of the leading sports architects in the world, on the development, which is breathtaking in its scope." City also have plans to redevelop the East Stand at the King Power Stadium to increase the total capacity to around 40,000, but the training ground is the first project to be undertaken. The new training facility was one of the dreams of City's late chairman, Vijay Shinadanaprava, who believed the site could help propel the club towards competing with Europe's elite clubs by helping to attract players. City have not revealed what they plan to do with their current training facility at Belvoir Drive, which has been their training base since 1963. Before that, City trained at various venues around the city, including the car parks at Filbert Street and on a recreation ground that used to be behind the main stand. At various times, they also used the nearby Dunlop Sports Ground at St Mary's Mills, the electricity sports ground on Aylston Road. City's training facility will include a covered show pitch with 499 seats, spectator toilets, and an elevated camera platform, 12 full-sized football pitches, 6 part-sized grass pitches, 2 goalkeeper areas, 1 attacking area, 5 warm-up and technical training areas, a sports hall, a training centre to be used by the first team and academy, with hydrotherapy, medical rehabilitation and dining facilities. It will also have education facilities, offices and 30 bedrooms for the players and management stores and its own power plant. There will be 421 parking spaces, with 8 coach parking bays, with coach parking bays with disabled and electric parking spaces. It will also boast the UK's first sports turf academy to train groundsmen.
City just lack killer touch if Vardy is left out.
Tottenham Hotspur 3, Leicester City 1. Claude Puel must have the skin of a rhinoceros. The Leicester City manager would have been fully aware when he made the decision to drop his main striker Jamie Vardy against title-chasing Tottenham Hotspur. It would be controversial. The Frenchman doesn't seem fazed by the criticism he has received from a section of the City support or the media. But when he pulled Jamie Vardy aside and told him he would be starting from the bench at Wembley, he would have been fully aware that if things went wrong at Spurs, he was leaving himself open to even more stick. To some it was a strange decision, to others it was brave, but to his blue army baiters it beggared belief. Puel attempted to explain the decision by stating before the game he was shaking things up to find another way forward without Vardy so he could ease the goal-scoring pressure on his top scorer. It was tantamount to admitting he was using the game as an experiment. Last weekend, Vardy was seen saying something less than complimentary in the direction of Puel and Paul Pogba following the 1-0 defeat to Manchester United. Puel insisted there was no issue with Vardy on his part, stating menacingly that if there had been any disrespect shown to him or the club, then he would take action. Sources close to Vardy have also refuted a falling out, but the timing of Puel's decision to drop Vardy would only pour a gallon of gasoline on that fire. Whether there is a problem between the pair, and both camps would refute there is, one thing is clear. Puel is preparing for life without Vardy, which is puzzling, considering he has just signed a new contract. he doesn't want to be over-reliant on his one true goalscorer, especially if they don't see eye to eye. When you make such a big call, you hope and pray it pays off, but if the intention was to show Vardy that he isn't irreplaceable at City, he proved the opposite, that without him, City lack that final killer touch. Puel's youngsters played some exciting attacking football and had 20 efforts on goal, 9 of which were on target, but it was only after Vardy's introduction did they have a focal point. It says a lot about the attacking options Puel has at his disposal and how he rates them that winger Damari Gray was again given a game as the number 9. Kelechi Iheanacho and Shinji Okazaki will have noted that with disappointment. Gray worked hard in his unnatural position, but looked much more comfortable when he moved into wide areas, and it was following Vardy's introduction on the hour that City had much more punch up front. Of course, it was Vardy who saw his penalty saved by Hugo Lloris when he had just come on the pitch. That was another brave call from Puel as he made the substitution, because James Maddison was preparing to take the spot kick awarded for Jan Vertonghen's challenge on him. Maddison had missed his previous two, but Vardy hadn't even touched the ball. Had it gone in, it would have looked like a masterful decision. It didn't, and Puel was left open to more criticism. With Vardy starting the game on the sidelines, and Mark Albrighton now ruled out for the season with a hamstring injury, goalkeeper Kasper Schmeichel was the only player left who started regularly in the 2016 title-winning season on the pitch. He, along with Vardy, has also recently signed a new contract to commit his future to the club. But Puel will be concerned by his comments made on Be In Sport by his father Peter. The former Manchester United keeper effectively said Kasper would love a move to a bigger club, but that there simply weren't any opportunities to do so at the moment. He also stated frankly that City would be better off without Puel. It was another hit that Puel will have to take, and he has taken more in recent months than a one-armed boxer. However, there was some hope to lift Puel's spirits. The performance of his young players will have provided a welcome tonic. Harvey Barnes may have missed some really good chances, but the fact a lad making only his third start in the Premier League had the ability to get into such positions and hurt an experienced Spurs defence with his directness and positivity bodes well, as long as he doesn't dwell too much on his finishing at Wembley and lose confidence. Maddison was much more effective in his number 10 role before Gray, while Youri Tielemans produced a debut that will encourage the City fans. Papi Mendy and Wilfred Ndidi offer too much of the same thing. Both are defensively minded and often seem to get in each other's way. Tielemans and his ability on the ball and vision, which he displayed to play Barnes in behind the Spurs defence in the first half, will add a different dimension for Puel. However, the Frenchman must realise that his best option for having a player on the end of those chances is the man he really can't do without right now, Vardy. There's no point having thick skin if you cut your own nose off to spite your face.
Local football.
County student clinches pro deal. A Ratcliffe College student has signed a long-term professional contract with a championship club. Year 11 student Finn Beck, son of former Leicester Tigers and England star Neil, has agreed terms with Nottingham Forest. He will begin the scholarship programme on July the 1st after his summer examinations, followed by a 3-year professional contract which will begin 3 months later on his 17th birthday in September. Finn's parents, Alison and Neil, paid tribute to staff at the school, thanks to the staff at Radcliffe College who have supported Finn since the age of 3, helping him achieve his dream. His efforts are now still very much steered towards his upcoming GCSEs, where we're sure he will do us all and himself proud. Finn comes from a family with a very strong sporting background, with Dad Neil, a former international rugby union footballer for England and the British and Irish Lions. Finn's older sister, Olivia, moved from Ratcliffe College last year to go on to join the GB ladies hockey team, a fantastic start to her sporting career. Amanda Stafford, director of sport at Ratcliffe College, said, "Throughout his time with us, Finn has been an excellent sportsman, a wonderful role model to his peers and younger students, and all-round sportsman. He has been involved in 2 hockey national finals, where he was a pivotal part of the team, as well as playing in the A-teams for rugby and cricket. Finn has done extremely well to secure his football scholarship and 3-year professional contract at such a young age. We are so proud of him and his achievements. We wish him well and we look forward to seeing him on Match of the Day soon."
Town in good shape for top of the table clash. United Counties League Division 1. Melton Town 4, Bourne Town 0.
Melton Town saw off the first snow of winter and warmed up for their biggest week of the season with another impressive win against Bourne. Home supporters were out in force early on Saturday morning, brushing snow off the pitch in order to get the game played, determined to give Town the chance to extend their great winning run to 9 ahead of their top-of-the-table showdown at Anstey. Bourne had kept out Melton until the very last minute in the reverse fixture back in December, but Town have come far in the 6 weeks since that pivotal win. Just 2 changes were made, with Hibbett replacing Hill and Gilchrist coming in for Lever. Melton's third largest crowd of the season braved the weather and were almost rewarded inside 5 minutes when co-manager John Stevenson broke through in midfield and sent a shot from the edge of the area, which whistled narrowly past the far post. Wilson then got his head to a Stevenson corner, which beat the keeper, but landed on the roof of the net as the hosts pressed for their customary early goal. And there was no surprise when, after just 9 minutes, Westwood won the ball in midfield, slipped past 2 tackles, and played in Reeve, who ghosted into the penalty area and fired a low shot past the keeper to give Melton a deserved lead. The host started to play some great football, passing it around the pitch with confidence, and they made it 2-0 midway through the half when Bourne failed to clear their lines from a corner. The ball bounced around the box until Stevenson sent a powerful volley goalwards, which appeared to deceive the keeper as he deflected it into his own net. Reeve almost made it 3 just minutes later when he turned and shot from the edge of the area, but he was denied by a great save and goal line clearance. And on the half hour, Westwood drove into the area and dinked the ball to Reeve, whose reflex shot was tipped around the post. The second half started as the first half had finished, with Levi Frey bursting into the box and teeing up Stevenson, whose rasping shot was deflected around the post. The resulting corner was cleared only as far as Stevenson, whose shot was deflected once more, but this time to Reeve, who had a close-range tap-in for his 4th goal in 2 games. There was no let-up, with Stevenson's curling free kick brilliantly tipped over and Parsons going close with a long-range shot. Young Kyle Reek was introduced after 63 minutes and had an immediate impact when he played a 1-2 with Levi Frey and drove straight into the area. A beautiful ball across the 6-yard box found the oncoming Arnold, who made no mistake from 4 yards. Bourne's first real chance came with just 4 minutes left when Munton was found unmarked in the area but headed wide of an open goal. Melton turned in a performance of the highest order to make it 9 wins in a row and 6 clean sheets in 7 games. The result drew them level on points with second-placed Lutterworth Town, who have a game in hand, and kept them within 3 points of Division 1 leaders Anstey Nomads, who they visit on Saturday, kick-off 3 p.m. Town then host Barrowtown on Tuesday, February the 12th, in the County Senior Cup semi-final at Melton Sports Village, kick-off 7:30 p.m.
Tigers News.
Sport and history locked in a drink. A local brewery has combined its canal heritage and love for rugby with a new beer. In celebration of local heritage as well as local heroes in the world of rugby, Langton Brewery has brewed a new beer, especially for the Six Nations Rugby Championship. Named the Local Lock to celebrate the brewery's links to local canals and Foxton Locks in particular, and on this occasion a local rugby hero too, Ben Kay, former lock at Tigers, and also part of the winning England World Cup team in 2003, who lives near Foxton Locks. The local canals and locks have inspired the branding for all of Langton's traditional ales, with brewery's signature brew, Inclined Plain, named after the Victorian canal barge lift at Foxton Locks in Leicestershire, in operation from 1900 to 1910. Visiting the brewery last week, Ben Kay said, "It is great to be associated with a beer that celebrates both the local heritage in the area I live in, as well as the game of rugby and the Six Nations Championship. A winning combination if ever there was one." Local Lock is a crisp copper ale with a caramel-like maltiness in aroma and flavour with a subtle hint of spice. It is brewed to 4% alcohol volume, which makes it a very quaffable, hoppy, session ale, ideal as an accompaniment to watching the Six Nations Rugby Championship.
The beer will be available in local pubs throughout the Six Nations Championships, culminating in a beer festival being held in collaboration with and at the ground of Kibworth Cricket Club over the last weekend of play in the competition, March the 15th to the 17th.
Local rugby.
Discipline issues cannot prevent Harborough seeing off rivals. Market Harborough came out on top in the third versus second showdown in Midlands 2 East South. They hosted St Ives, an uncompromising side full of big players, who won the reverse fixture earlier in the season. But on this occasion, it was Harborough who triumphed 45-24 to leapfrog their opponents. Harborough started strongly, and it was not long before returning skipper Josh Purnell showed his class with a dominant break before releasing Harvey Slade, who in turn put Harry Durham in for a score converted by Lawrence Joel. A turnover by Jake Fordham in his own 22 then saw the ball reach Slade, who outstripped the defence before passing inside to Mika Basra to touch down. St Ives hit back with a deserved try of their own, but from the kickoff, a knock-on gave Harborough a scrum in the middle of the park, just outside the 22, and number 8 Chris Braille picked up, made ground, and passed to Joel, who made it 17-5. A yellow card for Finlay Smith left the home side a man down, and St Ives took advantage to move within 5 points at 17-12. But Harborough remained in control and collected their bonus point score after an excellent chase by Timmy Waterfield set the platform for Basra to touch down. The penalty count against Harborough was worrying though, as Stuart Bale received a yellow card for kicking the ball out of the ruck. But being a man short did not halt Harborough's endeavour, and they saw Basra and Joel combine to put Durham in. The score then became 38-12 shortly after, when the ever-industrious Waterfield set up Chris Bale to storm over. Some overconfidence and an unnecessary pass led to the interception try for St Ives, and they added another to earn a bonus point. But Harborough still looked comfortable, despite another yellow card, this time for Purnell. And Joel was on hand to leap high in the air and catch an excellent box kick for his second and Harborough's seventh try. Head coach Joe Hill said, "There is some concern about the indiscipline, but I'm satisfied that as a team, we are now showing what we are capable of and can finish our aim of finishing in the top two."
International rugby.
Jones sets sights on greatest ever Welsh side as May flays the French.
Six Nations rugby. England 44 points, France 8 points.
England head coach Eddie Jones turned his sights to the greatest Welsh side ever after a resounding mauling of France gave his men 2 wins from 2 Guinness Six Nation games. England backed up their victory in Ireland with a 44-8 defeat of Les Bleus at Twickenham, falling 1 point short of the record margin of victory of 37 points set in 1911. Tigers winger Johnny May scored a first-half hat-trick, and there were tries for Henry Slade, Owen Farrell, and a penalty try, as England kept hapless France scoreless in the second half. Farrell kicked an additional 14 points. Next for Jones's men is a trip to Cardiff on February the 23rd, with Jones apparently having forgotten the great Wales sides of the 1970s and the Grand Slam winners of 2005, 2008 and 2012 in his assessment of Warren Gatland's men. "There's a lot more in this team, and we understand that, and we're committed to being the very best we can be," Jones said. "When we get back together on Wednesday, we'll start the process of how we can get better again. We're playing the greatest Welsh side ever. We're going to have to be at our absolute best. You know you're playing against a Warren Gatland side. He's been at the top of the tree in European rugby for the past 15 years, through his club and country and the Lions. You're playing against a tough, physical team. They contest hard at the breakdown. You've got to earn every point against them. We're looking forward to going down there. Should be fun." England led 30-8 at the interval, with 4 tries earning a bonus point victory. But Jones insisted the second half performance was even better. "I think when you put yourself in position where after 30 minutes you've got a bonus point against a top team, you've done pretty well," he said. "And the second half, I thought our performance was even better. Even though we didn't score as many points, our focus and our discipline to keep France scoreless was outstanding. But we just had a quick chat in the room there and we felt we'd probably left 15 to 20 points on the field." Jones reserved particular praise for May, who took his test tally to 22 tries in 42 appearances, with two of his scores coming as reward for chasing kicks. Jones said, "Johnny May's like when you go to the park and you see someone with a tennis ball and they throw it. The dog runs 100 miles per hour and chases it and brings it back. He does that pretty well." England have enjoyed success through their tactical kicking game in Dublin and now against Le Bleu, but Jones hinted at varied tactics to come at the Principality Stadium. "There's always space because you've only got 15 players," Jones said. "At the moment, we're having a great deal of success with our kicking, but that could create opportunities in the next game somewhere else." Prop Mako Vunipola was replaced and required the application of ice to his left ankle, but Jones was uncertain of the severity of the injury. France replied through a Morgan Parra penalty and a Damien Penaud try in an error-strewn performance which does not bode well in World Cup year. The teams meet again in Yokohama in October. France head coach Jacques Brunel said, "Obviously I'm very, very disappointed. I'm most of all disappointed with what happened in the first half. We were really under pressure from the English side, especially from their kicking game, and we were not able to overcome that." France captain Guillaume Guiardo added, "It's very painful when they score try after try. The pressure was constant, and we never managed to get out of that."
Basketball.
Our successful doubleheader shows how vital it is to have a quality squad. It is that time of the year when squads in the BBL are fully tested, and, as a coach, you find out about who can step up when key players get injured. Last weekend, we saw that emphasised and we were really happy with the results. We went into the doubleheader without our injured joint top scorer DeAndre Burnett, and first up were Sheffield Sharks, who also lost their captain Mike Tuck to injury. We wanted to go inside early and establish our superiority in the paint, with Tuck out, and with our new signing Tim Williams looking at home within our offence, we were pleased with the way the first quarter went. What we could not have possibly anticipated is our three veterans, J.R. Holder, Pierre Hampton and Andy Thompson, all having such an off night shooting, going a combined 5 from 31. Few would have given us much chance in those circumstances, but we got an exceptional performance from Connor Washington, who did not miss a shot from the floor, and showed real maturity in running the point. We got the full 40 minutes out of him too, and it was an outstanding effort, because as well as the points, he was constantly talking and directing the offence. He was exceptional. We also got a great contribution from Josh Ward-Hibbert, our energy guy. The former tennis player is a superb athlete and always gives us a boost when he enters the game. He is growing in confidence with every game, and he again made big plays at both ends of the court against Sheffield. Our victory by 8 points was fully deserved, because all our guys maintained their defensive intensity, irrespective of whether baskets were dropping at the other end. The following night, Manchester Giants were also down 2 players through injury, but they were a very hard-to-guard team, as we found yet again in the first quarter when they rattled in 28 points. But we held our nerve. Williams again began to establish himself inside against their all-star Willie Clayton, and we quickly dragged the game our way. Jamel Anderson was outstanding defensively, covering a range of their players, and once again, Washington was in brilliant form. 6 triples from 8 attempts, all while running the point and dishing out 8 assists, and with just 3 turnovers was superb, particularly after his efforts the night before, and he showed once again his exceptional levels of fitness. We were finally able to win one at home, with something to spare, and I was immensely proud of the reception the Morningside Arena faithful gave to Washington and Ward-Hibbert when I finally gave them a well-deserved rest late on in the game. On another relatively quiet night for our big guns, Holder, Thompson and Hampton, we outscored the Giants 32-0 in terms of contribution from the bench. It was also 21-7 in our favour at Sheffield. It once again shows the importance of having a squad of evenly matched players who are flexible and can fill multiple roles, particularly at this stage of the season when the injuries pile up. We face another doubleheader this weekend, starting with Cheshire Phoenix at home on Friday night. We have not seen the Phoenix since pre-season, which means 3 of our remaining fixtures will be against a team who have strengthened with the re-signing of 7-foot centre CJ Gettys. They have a really balanced attack. Then, the long trip follows on Sunday for an early Sunday tip-off against Plymouth Raiders. They are big scorers, as we saw on their recent visit to Leicester, and so, We are going to need all our squad to wear them down defensively.
Wolves seen off as Riders stretch winning run to 9.
Leicester Riders women got their defence of the WBBL trophy off to a winning start as they beat Auckland's Wolves 94-67 on the road in the South Group 2. Riders had already won twice at Auckland's this campaign in the League and Cup and now hold 9 straight wins over Wolves since October 2016. Riders Australian centre Kate Oliver scored the opening 2 baskets of the contest as Riders started 6-0 in the first 3 minutes before they led 13-4 on Jennifer Ashton's 3-pointer. Once a double-digit lead was established at 16-6, Riders' young GB star Holly Winterburn hit the first of her 2 early triples and the team never looked back. They led 25-10 after the first quarter and, in spite of a brief Wolves fightback, established a 43-32 lead at half-time. The game was settled when Leicester scored the first 12 points of the third period in another 5-minute scoreless spell for Auckland's. Riders' defence was too much for Auckland's as they nabbed a massive 15 steals in the game, while also restricting the Wolves to just 33% shooting from the field and out-rebounding them 61-44. Holly Winterburn filled the stat sheet once more in another all-action display. She came close to an extraordinary triple-double with 29 points, 11 rebounds and 8 steals, hitting 5 from 10 three-pointers. Rebecca Navarro added 17 points and Oliver 16.
Riders draw level at top after fabulous weekend. Leicester Riders moved level on points with league leaders London Lions after a dramatic come-from-behind 90-87 victory at Plymouth Raiders. It was a sensational weekend for the Riders after seeing off Cheshire Phoenix in another close-fought encounter on Friday. Riders had made it 7 wins from 8 as they saw off a dogged Phoenix side 76-69 at the Morningside Arena. Despite being an injury concern after sustaining an ankle knock in training, Josh Ward-Hibbert continued his sensational run of form to score 8 of Leicester's 11 unanswered points in the game's decisive run. Pierre Hampton and J.R. Holder, who had been quiet in the last couple of games, both came out of the blocks firing in the early stages, but Cheshire matched them score for score. Holder's 3rd three-pointer of the opening quarter helped Leicester to take a 3-point lead into the second period. The Knicks suffered a major blow when Dijon Alan Jordan fell awkwardly, injuring his hip and leaving the game in the second period. But despite good play from Hampton and Andy Thompson, Riders were still unable to pull away, and with 3 minutes to go in the first half, it was 34-32. Hampton scored Riders' last 12 points of the first half, including all of an 11-2 run that had them 9 points clear. Cheshire, though, posted 9 of the first 11 third-quarter points to lead 46-45, and when Lewis Sayers and Momsilo Latinovic netted back-to-back threes, the visitors were 54-48 ahead. 7 Tim Williams points meant Riders were only a basket behind going into the fourth quarter, before Ward-Hibbert inspired the final charge. As well as his points, he had 2 offensive rebounds, 2 steals and a big block shot in a sensational 4-minute spell that saw Leicester to victory. Hampton led the way with 20 points, while Holder, 15 points and Thompson, 16 points, also looked back to their best, and defensively, Riders were in fine form again, holding an opponent under 70 points for the 8th time this season. Riders followed up that win with a 90-87 victory at the Raiders. Riders trailed by double figures with just over a quarter to go, but 34 points from Tim Williams and another great effort from Josh Ward-Hibbert saw them maintain their winning run. A string of first-quarter three-pointers by the home side had them out to an 18-8 lead after only 5 minutes. But while Riders were able to slow the Raiders' offence down in the second part of the period, they were unable to make any inroads into the lead and trailed 24-13 at the first break. 4 points from Josh Ward-Hibbert capped a 7-0 start to the second quarter by the Riders that had the deficit down to 5, but Plymouth pulled clear at 36-24. Tim Williams, though, scored 13 points in the second quarter and 6 in a 12-4 spell that narrowed the arrears to 40-36. There were still 4 points between the sides at half-time, but the home side posted a run of 11 unanswered points midway through the third quarter to lead 58-45. 6 points from Ward-Hibbert and a clever steal and 1 layup by Brandon Clark on his second debut for the Riders had the gap down to only 5 late in the third. 6 points from Williams early in the fourth had the gap down to 68-67, but the home side were able to edge back clear thanks to 3s from Dante Nicholas and Josh Wiltshire. Leicester, though, were able to hold the Raiders scoreless for the next 4 minutes, scoring 10 without reply to lead 82-77. Two spectacular efforts from Holder and a steal and dunk from Kiefer Dowse put Leicester 86-79 ahead, but Plymouth netted back-to-back triples to make it a one-point game with 50 seconds remaining. Riders ran the clock, and Williams scored on the shot clock buzzer to push Riders 3 points clear, but Plymouth responded with 13 seconds left to cut the lead. After a string of fouls to stop the clock, Plymouth lost Williams underneath, and he jammed in the winner.
Flames trio burn brightly as GB finish 5th in Latvia. A trio of Leicestershire basketball players had to dig deep when they travelled to Latvia to represent Great Britain at the CSIS Cup, a competition for athletes over 40. Moat Flames players Hazel Shaw, Lynette Bentley and Linda Bryan were joined on the trip east by coach Susie Hockerstan-Maguire, who is a mentor with the Leicester Riders women's team. The GB squad, who are preparing for the World Masters Championships in Finland this summer, finished 5th in a highly competitive tournament made up largely of high-class sides from Baltic region. The games were short and sharp, played over 10-minute periods with a running clock. Team GB opened with a win against Team Sigalia from Lithuania. However, they then lost a tough encounter to the eventual tournament runners-up, Sungate from Estonia. That left the British squad in the playoffs for 4th to 6th places, where they faced Irish outfit Glasnevin and were pipped in overtime by a point. They responded strongly though and finished the tournament in style with a victory over Latvia to take 5th place. The squad continue their build-up to the Worlds with a training session at Leicester's Morningside Arena next month. Their next competitive outing is the Santander Masters in Spain at the end of May.
Archery.
Jibril takes top spot in 18-metre tournament.
Tom Cram and Arthur Coveney have often dominated the county indoor tournaments, but it was Jason Jibril who claimed top spot at the Foresters 18-metre tournament at Brockington College. After taking time out from competing at the end of the summer to work on technique, the Paradox archer has improved significantly during the winter. In this, the first tournament after the Christmas break, he produced an outstanding performance to consign teammate Cram to second place. Lutterworth's Mark Rowley finished third, his second bronze in successive tournaments. Luke Gill, who missed out on first by a point before Christmas at the Foxes, was again impressive in the men's compound. The Paradox archer claimed the top spot, but had to share it with Andy Brooks of Six Towns Company of Archers, who produced the same score. Familiar faces filled the top spots in the longbow through Steve Wilkinson and national clout champion Katrina Charters, back to winning ways after second place at the Foxes. Conor Haldane, on home territory, claimed his first win in the men's barebow. Otherwise, the top places went to out-of-county archers, Anne Smith having to settle for third in the recurve, and Jill Brown second in the compound, with Six Towns very much to the fore. The Stoke Club produced a strong all-round performance to win the recurve team competition, while the horse team of Neil Brown, David Lee and Jill Brown claimed the compound. Among the juniors, the outstanding performance came from Kirby Muxlow's Esme Ryan, age 14, who won the girls' recurve. Welland Valley's Corin Wilcox, who has also shown marked improvement during the winter, won the boys' recurve.
Athletics.
Mari scorches to international win. Middle-distance runner Mari Smith has made a stunning start to the season with the world's fastest time and an international win. The 22-year-old is in a transitional year on the track as she steps up from a successful junior career into the senior ranks. There is also the considerable matter, away from sport, of completing the final year of a master's degree in biochemistry at Birmingham University. But Smith has so far taken it all in her stride, having set a blistering early pace. At the start of the year, she became the world's fastest 800-metre women's runner in winning an early season race. The mark may have lasted just a few days, and Smith was quick to add its proper context, but it offered plenty of encouragement after a winter of training. "It was pretty cool, but it was very early season," she said. "My boyfriend messaged me after I'd raced. He's a lot more into the stats of athletics than I am." She added, "It's a nice confidence boost to know that I've still got some speed, even though, A lot of the winter training I've been doing is based work, so aerobic training. Of more lasting value, perhaps, was her call-up into the England squad for an international indoor meet in Bratislava late last month. There she controlled the women's 800 metres, leading from gun to tape to win the race by 6 seconds in a season's best time of 2 minutes and 4.92 seconds. It was very much a time trial, but the time ranked me 15th in the world, so I was very pleased with this as an opener to my indoor season, she said. Smith, who grew up in Frisbee, made her senior international track debut last summer, running and winning in the England vest at Loughborough and Manchester. But Slovakia was her senior overseas debut. Yet delayed flights out to Slovakia gave a quick reality check of the not-so-glamorous side of competing abroad. It's always an honour to run for your country, so it was lovely, she added. It was fun, but there was a lot of travelling, and unfortunately the flights were very late Saturday and very early Monday morning, with the race being on Sunday, so I didn't get to see Bratislava at all. The older athletes in my group said, "Welcome to the world of international athletics." Last year was the high watermark of Smith's athletics career to date. She claimed the coveted British Universities and Colleges, BUCS, 800-metre title and followed it with a national senior crown by becoming English 800-metre champion. The Birchfield Harrier also ran her season's goal of 2 minutes 2 seconds, considerably lowering her 2017 personal best by a second and a half. While athletes live and die by times on the stopwatch and titles on the CV, one of the biggest upsides of last season's achievements was their effect on her self-belief, a concept she admits she has struggled with at times. "I'd love to build on the confidence I gained last year and really crack the British trials this year," she added. "Confidence, while keeping athletics fun, can be hard for me to gain and maintain, so that's actually one of my main aims for this season." The student is also aware of the need for patience this year and the ability to put results into their correct perspective as she continues her education in senior track. But it won't limit her growing ambition. "It's kind of a stepping stone year for me, I feel," she explained. "I hope to run a personal best in the 800 and consistently run around that time. Consistency is definitely key. Transitioning into the senior age group can be hard, so I've just got to keep working hard and trusting my training. The bigger picture is more important than this season alone, but I would like to try to get my name noticed for future selection. I'm really hoping to break through to compete at the very highest levels of UK women's 800 metre running in the next few years, hopefully making some international championships."
Cycling.
"I've been tough on myself, but I have enjoyed training."
As the new road racing season nears, Cosby's Grace Garner has just swapped the chill of the UK for a warm weather spell in Spain. Here, the high-tech professional reflects on a winter training programme which has seen her putting in the miles in Leicestershire and Yorkshire before heading off to Calpe. "My busy winter training programme has been split between roads at home and in Yorkshire over the past few months. The training I do is massively different up north, and I have been able to travel there more regularly this winter, and for longer spells. I can really feel the difference, especially when I am climbing, and there's plenty of that, as you can imagine. In terms of speed, I can usually hold around 30 kilometers per hour when I'm training in the county, if it's not a super windy day. In Yorkshire, it might only be around 20 kilometers per hour, because it is so hilly. There are never any easy rides around Yorkshire. My boyfriend, Gabs Kulake, who rides with Team Wiggins, lives in Holmfirth, which is not far from Huddersfield in West Yorkshire. We can easily get out into the Peak District from Gabs's hometown, but we can also go to an area to the east, which is pan flat, with really straight roads. So it is the best of both worlds for our training, really. My favourite ride, when I am in Yorkshire, takes us across to Meltham and Marsden, and then over Saddleworth Moor. The views are gorgeous. We usually do that in a 3-hour loop, but it is easy to add in extra kilometres if we need to. I'm currently working in 3-day blocks, which is usually 3 days on the bike training hard, then 1 day riding easy or gym work. It does vary, but that is the plan I work around. At the moment, my rides are mostly 3 to 4 hours. Our races don't tend to go over 4 hours, but I'd like to get 1 or 2 4-plus-hour rides in a week. As we look to squeeze out the last winter miles in some good weather, I'm out in Spain with my sister Lucy and our new teammate, Shanella Stauchje, who has also joined High Tech for this season. Shanella is from the Netherlands, and I know her from our time racing in the youth tour of Assen, where we both had our successes. It is going to be hard work in Calpe, and the rides will be heavy on the hours and efforts over 9 days, but I'm looking forward to training with Shanella and Lucy, of course. I start my season in March, and like anybody, I can't wait to get racing again. I'm with a new team and feel like I've had my most consistent winter yet. I have learned a lot about myself and what I'm capable of, and I've trusted in my training program. I've definitely been a lot mentally tougher on myself, and I've enjoyed the training more than ever before.
Golf.
County golfing pair enjoy success in the Middle East desert.
Two leading county playing professionals enjoyed success in Jordan when they competed in a qualifying school for the 2019 Middle East and North Africa Tour. Alistair Kinniard of Kirby Muxlow and Ashley Mason of Glen Gorse both gained their full playing rights for this year's tour. Kinniard, winner of the County Open Championship for the past two seasons, was tied runner-up with his 6-under-par 210 aggregate over the Ayla course at Aqaba after his rounds of 70, 68, 72, with Mason joint 15th on 221 after his 74, 71, 76 returns. Another sectional qualifier is now underway, and the opening tour tournament of the season takes place a few days later over this same Greg Norman-designed course. Both pros were delighted and are looking forward to their top playing opportunities ahead. Mason said, "The course was a good test of golf on a very typical style of desert course. The weather was good, although it was very windy, especially on the last day when conditions were far more extreme." Kinniard said, "I am very happy with how I have played for the 3 days and delighted to have had such a strong finish. I felt really comfortable out there in contention and feel this has given me a lot of confidence moving forward." The pair now have a few days off while the other qualifying takes place, with their next event, the 2019 Tour Opener, set to start on Saturday over 54 holes, with a two-round cut. Mason added, "I will definitely play the second tour event at Al Zora in Ajman, a state 40 minutes from Dubai. I'm relieved to have my full status because I didn't really have my best golf game, especially in the wind, and had to be sensible off the tee and stay patient. Hopefully I can get some good work done to get competitive in the coming weeks." Kinniard is flying home after Jordan to make plans for the rest of the spring, but may return to play Al Zora. Both are hoping to play as many events as they can, depending on funds.
Golf in brief. Michael Reid,
Glen Gorse,
won the Top Professionals Award in the County Golf Alliance tournament for the second meeting in a row when he scored 33 points at Beadles Lake Golf Club on a bitterly cold day. Reid finished 2 points clear of John Williamson,
Birstall,
and there was a tie on 30 points for third between Matt Ulliott,
Lutterworth,
and Matthew Court of the host club. Reid, now with 66 points, heads the Pro Order of Merit, being run in conjunction with the 2018-19 Alliance campaign, with Williamson second on 59, ahead of Craig Shave of Cosby on 44, and Neil Parker of Humberston Heights, fourth on 35. Kibworth amateurs Tom Nimmo and Simon Myers were first overall with 41 points, but only after a tie resolved on Alliance rules from Ulliott and Lutterworth amateur Martin Walker. Walker is now top of the overall Alliance Order of Merit with 26 points, one clear of Dennis Hewitt, with Tony Crowfoot third on 23, and John Spatcher and Bob Watts joint fourth on 21. Hinckley's Stuart Prime and Kev Courtney, with 40 points, were third at Beadles Lake. Williamson and Dave Stewart,
Birstall,
won the Pro-Am Section Award, with scrapped-off golf club pair Mark Quinn Jarvis and Marcus Pearsomth, Am-Am Section prize winners. The third and final County Golf Union New Winter Series of medal tournaments for leading local amateurs is taking place on Sunday at the Leicester Golf Club. Competition has been fierce in the first two rounds of this inaugural event, which aims to identify potential emerging county golfers as well as keep the squads together throughout the closed season. County Captain Martin Anderson,
Glen Gorse,
heads the Order of Merit so far with his total of 200 points, having won the first round at Kirby Muxlow and achieving another high finish when round two was decided, also at the Leicestershire. This weekend, double points are at stake, so there could be changes. Anderson's closest challengers going into the final competition are Freddie MacArthur,
Ullesthorpe Court,
the round two winner, with 185 points.
County's second-team skipper, John Fairbrother.
Cosby
is third on 155 points, with his clubmate James Billingham, the county vice-captain, fourth on 150 points. Cosby's Matt Payton is the net order of merit pace-setter, with his 187.5 points haul from two on 55, McCarver and Stuart Marriott.
Cosby,
a former county first-team captain, and Cameron Chalmers,
Allisthorpe Court,
the 2018 County Boys Match Play Champion, 150 points, in fourth.
Hockey.
Lucky Leo moves Melton up to third. Melton Hockey Club's new signing, Leo Guy, made another telling contribution as the first 11 moved up to third in East Midlands Division 1. After scoring and assisting in their previous win, Guy was again at the fore in Melton's 3-2 win at Berkswell and Balsall Common, although this time the sporting gods provided a few slices of fortune along the way. The game was at first cancelled as temperatures dived, but then was put back on after the home side declared the pitch playable. There was a danger lack of preparation might see the Reds start slowly after their rush to the ground, but from the first whistle, they charged forward, dominating possession and threatened with nearly every attack. Young brothers Freddie and Jacob Welch, making their first start together, never looked overawed by the step-up in levels, and both made key contributions in attack. But it was Syburn and Kendall who combined to open the scoring. In what had become a trademark move, Syburn burst down the right and squared for Kendall to sweep home a deserved goal. As the pressure continued, Melton racked up a series of penalty corners, but it took until the fourth in the sequence for Guy to find the charmed touch, which extended the lead. Brooks dragged the set piece to Snow, who stopped the ball for Guy, who attempted to sling his shot towards the top left corner, but the ball slid off the end of his stick, gently nestling in the opposite corner of the goal, and wrong-footing the hapless keeper. Berkswell tried to rally, but Melton's tempo was too much, as chances came and went for Kendall, Pollard and Syburn. Melton needed to take advantage of their dominance, and again upstepped Guy at the crucial moment. After dribbling around two players, he swung wildly on his reverse, launching the ball goalwards. As his shot rose, a helpless defender ran across the ball's path and deflected into his own goal, as Melton's goalscorer was once more given a big helping hand. By half-time, the game looked over, but Melton knew they'd be tested in the second half. The Reds surrendered possession and soaked up pressure while springing counter-attacks. However, the counters no longer fell quite right, and Berkswell managed to get back into the game with a penalty corner of their own. A second goal followed as time started to run out, but the new-look Melton have added resilience this season, and the hosts never really threatened an equaliser. With young Jackson making a good debut in goal, Melton played sensible, controlled hockey to grind out the win, but in truth, the result could have been much more comfortable. On Saturday, Melton host Northampton Saints' second 11.
12:30pm start.
Netball.
Warriors pip Norfolk in Brooksby Thriller. Charnwood Rutland Warriors pipped Norfolk United in England Netball's National Premier League in a thriller at Brooksby. Their away visit to Norfolk saw Warriors lose by 2 points in the dying moments, and another tough game was expected. Warriors started poorly as Norfolk built a 4-0 lead, but they didn't panic and continued to settle in a new combination of McGlynn at centre and Robinson at wing attack. The defensive duo's move into attacking roles began to pay off, with Warriors finding a rhythm and scoring 7 unanswered points for a 19-13 first quarter lead. In the second quarter, Gallagher and Griffin continued to work well in the attacking end, frustrating Norfolk's defence and forcing changes. Warriors were finding it hard to shut down Norfolk's tall goal shooter, but held the lead at 30-26. Changes were made by both sides to combat the other, with individual mini-battles fought out across court. Warriors brought on Brock Taylor to add some speed through the midcourt,
while the defensive circle of Himes and Munro Hall worked tirelessly and continued to win turnover ball. But the hosts were struggling at the attacking end as Norfolk's defence piled on the pressure and the visitors found their rhythm to take a 41-39 lead. Warriors had a huge final quarter ahead and went back to their starting seven with Oakman returning to goalkeeper. The hosts worked tirelessly, chasing the game while Norfolk kept their centre passes safe. The defence were working overtime, which soon paid off when Oakham's interception was converted into the equaliser. It was followed by another turnover which gave Warriors the edge, with their centre to follow. They looked to be patient and keep the ball, but Norfolk again intercepted. But Munro Hall had the final say in a hectic final minute, intercepting Norfolk's centre pass and help Charnwood edge a highly competitive match 50-49. Sam Griffin was named player of the match.
Mavericks win out in a game with edge.
Club Coretti and Foxton Mavericks played out a firecracker of a match that saw tempers simmering throughout in the Market Harbour Netball League. Club Coretti stocked their claim on the match in the first quarter, only for Mavericks to focus and come out with a fire in their bellies for the second. The teams were evenly matched, with both having strength down the court, and every player determined to give it their all. The third quarter saw both teams score 10 goals each, but after a nail-biting 60 minutes, the Mavericks came out victorious 47-42. Coretti's Kim Walton and Louise Glover defended fearlessly, but had a tough job to keep the torrent of balls raining down on them from mid-court attacker Emily Bryan to sharpshooter Millie Van Nyrop. Snowfinder's clash with Turner's Tornadoes was slightly more one-sided, although the latter did manage to win one quarter. Snowfinder's shooters Amy Pelling and Evie Watts were on form, but Tornadoes refused to give in and had great linking play down the court from Jess Hughes and Sophie Chester. However, by the final whistle, Snowfinder's had won three quarters and the match 68-37. Foxton Flyers were no match for Aircare Thunder and lost 56-14. Thunder's Molly Barrow not only worked the centre court, but was also integral to shutting down Flyers' attack. A stoic performance from the Lutterworth Robins could not deny a strong MHBC team. Defender Fiona French was tested to the maximum in the first half of the match that saw BC set the platform for a Hannah Stratton-inspired 41-11 win. Foreman Falcons took all the points from Siamo Sirens. Beth Wallace controlled the midcourt, while Grace Brooks was on form with her shooting as Falcons won 54-17. The other match saw Aircare Lightning battle it out with Knighton. Both teams got a fast start, but Knighton were always just in control as they took points for the 47-34 win. However, points for the quarters were split.
Sailing.
Severe wind chill factor makes Memorial Event a daunting race. Trophy tussle is toughest test yet.
Neil Marsden and Johnny McGovern were the winners of the 2019 John Merrick's Tiger Trophy, which was held at Rutland Water over the weekend. Sailing an International 420, the Blackpool duo finished 3 points ahead of Simon Horsfield and Katie Burridge in a 2000, with another Int 420 of Aaron Holman and Pablo Garcia in third place. Horsfield and Burridge, representing the Army Sailing Association, were the winners of Sunday's pursuit race, with Marsden and McGovern finishing third. The event was the sixth in the Selden Sail Juice Winter Series and was the toughest yet, with a severe wind chill for three strong wind back-to-back handicap races on Saturday, followed by a gentler breeze for the pursuit race on Sunday. It is held in the memory of the late Johnny Merricks from Rutland, who won the first ever Tiger a quarter of a century ago in a 420 and went on to win the 420 World Championships. Johnny also won an Olympic silver medal in the 470, and Ian Walker, from his old crew, made a return to Rutland, crewing for Jess Lavery in the very same 470 that he and Johnny won their silver medal. The duo, representing the British sailing team, finished in 16th place. Ian commented, "It was great fun to sail with Jess, but I was shocked how hard I found something that was second nature 20 years ago. The racing was superb and we always had lots of private battles going on
around the racecourse, particularly with a Merlin rocket in the pursuit race. Saturday was very cold, with gusty northerly winds, and I take my hat off to everyone who stuck at it and sailed all three races. I am delighted that Johnny and my old 1996 Olympic 470 and its original sails, foils and spars all held together, despite a few ropes snapping. It is 20 years since it last sailed. I will admit to more than a few aches and pains on Monday morning. It was a brilliantly organised event that will have raised a large sum of money for the John Merrick Sailing Trust to help support youth sailing. It's also great to see that the winning crew, Johnny McGovern, was a JMST award recipient in 2002, when the JMST helped him and Olympic silver medalist in the 470, Stu Biffle, to buy a 420. Principal race officer David Wilkins was also delighted with the evening meal held in John Merrick's honour. He said, "The Tiger dinner was a great social occasion, with more than 120 diners enjoying the John Merrick's favourite meal, and a great talk from Ian Walker." He talked about the history of the Tiger Trophy, told a few stories about their successful partnership, including the last race of the 1996 Olympic Games. Ian explained the work of the JMST and his new Royal Yacht Association role, and GBR's Olympic prospects for Tokyo in 2020. This was followed by the auction of many goodies provided by Ian, Ben Ainsley, JMST Trust, and Selden Masts, and others. This raised close to £2,000 for the JMST. There were 137 entries in the Tiger this year. Because of the severe weather down south, there were 19 that could not make it to Rutland. So it was a fleet of 118 that made it to the start line, with 48 classes representing 78 different sailing clubs around the country. Marsden and McGovern in their 420 were deserved winners, finishing in the top three in all four races. Horsfield and Burridge were a strong finisher in all races too, while Holman and Pablo Garcia in their 420 were also very consistent in all races. Special mention must go to 10-year-old Harry George from Lymington in his 420, crewed by his dad, who finished 27th overall and 8th 420 out of a fleet of 23. Rutland Sailing Club pair Valerie Millward and Graham Hall finished in 31st and 32nd places respectively. Valerie, who is a part of Rutland Sailability, and Graham were both competing in challenges. Rutland's Andrew McKee was 36th in an RS Aero 7, while Nick Neave in a similar vessel was 67th. Other Rutland competitors were Jack Alderice, 76th, Alice Lucy, 85th, Steve and Ben Tilecoat, 87th, James Sainsbury, 101st, and Jamie Tilecoat, 104th.
Silver for Fletcher and Biffle, despite having to start all over again. Market Harbour sailor Dylan Fletcher and his partner Stuart Biffle kicked off their 2019 season with a 49er-class silver at the World Cup Series in Miami. Fletcher, who represented Britain in the Rio Olympics, and Biffle, a silver medalist from London 2012, went into the opening medal race of the 2019 Olympic classes calendar in the runner-up spot, but well within reach of victory. The pair, who won in Miami in 2017 and 2018, were dealt an early blow when they were among five boats judged to have been over the start line when the race began. They were therefore forced to turn back and restart the race, putting them at the back of the fleet. However, the remaining four boats, including fellow Brits James Peters and Flynn Sterrett, opted not to turn back and were handed maximum points for the race. For Peters and Sterrett, that meant an end to their medal hopes and a fifth-place finish overall. For Fletcher and Biffle, with just six boats now racing, it all but guaranteed them the silver medal. Third place in the medal race secured overall victory for Germans Eric Heil and Thomas Ploesel. "It was a difficult situation for us with the German team coming after us," Fletcher explained. "We had a game plan. Unfortunately, we were over the line, but age and wisdom has taught us to go back. After that, the results were set, and we had to settle for silver. It's a great start to the 2019 season, leaving us hungry for gold as we progress to the European regattas. Round 3 of the World Series will take place in Genoa in April.
Sports Awards.
Are you in the mix?
Melton Time Sports Awards 2018. Nominees announced.
Time's up. The deadline for nominations has passed, and today we reveal our full list of nominees for the Melton Time Sports Awards for 2018. We have been blown away by the quantity and quality of the response this year, and our judges faced a stiff task in whittling them down to just 3 finalists for 13 of our 16 awards, and then deciding the winners. The finalists will be announced in next week's Melton Times and online at www.meltontimes.co.uk from Thursday. All will be sent an invitation to attend our Gala Awards Night at Melton Mowbray's Market Banqueting Suite on Thursday, February the 28th. The judges will also drop shortlists for our top 2 awards, the Sports Personality of the Year and Junior Sports Personality of the Year. They will also be announced in next week's edition when voting will open for you to decide the winners of all these top 2 awards. Further to that, the judges will also choose the winner of our Special Recognition Award, who will be announced on the night. The awards evening, to be hosted for the second year running by BBC radio presenter Melvin Pryor, will see all of the winners unveiled in classic Oscars style. Melton Times sports editor Chris Harby said, "I'd like to thank everyone who has taken the time and trouble to nominate and also congratulate everyone who has made it this far. Last year's awards night was really well received and the interest this year has been incredible. I can't remember the last time we had so many nominees and there are a lot of new names, which is really pleasing and shows how healthy the awards are. A record number of sponsors are also getting behind the event this year, and we're delighted to see several new businesses joining us as well, as our long-time supporters. Without them, the night just wouldn't happen, so we'd like to say a huge thank you to them once again. To be recognised by your peers in this way is a success in itself, and I'm sure the judges will have a tough task in deciding who will make it through to our awards night. I would also like to say a huge thank you to our loyal supporters for their support once again, without whom we wouldn't be able to pay tribute to our local sporting stars."
Meet our nominees.
Sportsman of the Year.
Sponsored by Stuart Westmoreland.
Anthony Hart, Jason Barton, Chris Rogers, Mick Stevens, Stan Stannard, Gareth Thorley.
Sportswoman of the Year.
Sponsored by the Army.
Iman Barlow, Julie Bass, Emedy Fox, Bex Rimmington, Mary Smith, Natalie Tees.
Disability Sportsperson of the Year.
Sponsored by Harrison Security.
Andy Banks, Michael Wapples, Josh Whitfield.
Junior Sportsman of the Year.
Sponsored by Brooksby Melton College.
James Bartley, Brennan Goffigan, Will Graham, Morgan Peniston, Chris Randall.
Junior Sportswoman of the Year.
Available for sponsor.
Yasmin Bass, Saskia Davies, Libby Duncan, Amy Frederick, Amy Helstrip, Poppy Shaw, Maddie Rath.
School Sports Award.
Sponsored by Melton Vale Sixth Form College.
Ab Kettlebeek Primary School, Rosie Ashmore, Amy Copley, Lucas Gibbs, Charlie Haffenden, Jesse Houghton, Imogen Jones, Libby Perkins, Daisy Sharp, Jenny Sharp, Josh Whitfield.
Community Sport Award.
Sponsored by Melton Borough Council.
Sue Bailey, Jenny Beach, Serena Bignall, Katie Cowell, Claire Marlowe.
Team of the Year.
Sponsored by B&H Midland Services.
Asfordby FC Development, BCKA Kickboxing and Kung Fu, Hickling Cricket Club, Melton Marvels Netball, Melton Mowbray Tennis Club, Ladies First Team, Melton Mowbray Tennis Club, Men's First Team, Wymswold FC.
Junior Team of the Year.
Sponsored by ESF Events.
Asfordby Amateurs Under-14s Girls, Asfordby FC Under-10s Predators, Holwell Sports FC Academy, Mowbray Rangers Tigers Under-13s, John Fernley College Under-15s, Basketball.
Footballer of the Year.
Sponsored by Specsavers.
Junior Gaskin, Matt Hendy, Addison Isherwood, Charlie Richards, Michael Stevenson.
Cricketer of the Year.
Sponsored by Tom Flowers Cricket Coaching.
Tom Glover, Miles Hickman, Jamie Chew.
Unsung Hero of the Year.
Sponsored by Colin Moulds.
Bill Harding, Sue Millwood, Di McQuillan, Lol Pickin, Jim and Sharon Reason, Erica Warrington, Stuart Warby.
Coach of the Year.
Sponsored by Melton Mowbray Town Estate.
Simon Atherley, Mark Barlow, Rebecca Borg, Brent Horobin, Tom Cunnington, Richard Metcalf, Brent Peniston, Jenny Smith, Sean Staff, Erica Warrington.
Junior Sports Personality of the Year.
Sponsored by Samworth Brothers.
Shortlist to be announced next week.
Sports Personality of the Year.
Sponsored by Ragdale Hall.
Shortlist to be announced next week.
Special Recognition Award.
Sponsored by Stapleford Park.
Table Tennis.
Runners-up is Realistic Braunston AIM. MTTG continued their quest for the perfect season in the Stamford and Rutland League following an 8-2 victory over Uffington CCA, who themselves retained ambitions for honours. Dave Needham and Andy Goodacre remained unbeaten against determined opposition, for whom Steve Williams and Stacey Collins picked up consolation points, which may yet prove important as the season moves towards its conclusion. Braunston A might claim that they have closed the gap following a 9-1 win at Bourne B, but, with a 17-point deficit remaining, the runners-up spot is their realistic target. There were some competitive encounters in this match, with John Buck winning the first two sets against Carl Sleving and also taking Brian Bodicote to 5-ends. However, he had to settle for a consolation win over Basil Bagshaw. Sleving and Bodicote earned full houses for Braunston as they keep the challengers below them at bay. Braunston B have won two close matches in the past fortnight. Against Haringworth, they could not beat Dave Harvey but managed a 6-4 victory thanks to braces of wins for Bill Sees and Dave Webb. Sees and Webb won the key doubles match to secure the win. But the closest contest was the first one of the evening, as Frank Walsh recovered from two sets down to defeat the evergreen Cedric Phillips 13-11 at the fifth end. Braunston B also defeated Stamford Free Church 6-4, where, on this occasion, Matt Pape continued his fine recent form by remaining unbeaten. Vic Hoffman also won twice, but would have been disappointed to lose against Free Church's two-time winner, Adrian Bradley, having won the first two games in their encounter. Bradley and John Chambers won the final doubles in five games to earn another important point for the visitors.
Tennis.
Katie keeps her nerve to give Great Britain team a perfect start.
Great Britain were victorious in their first home Fed Cup tie since 1993 after Katie Boulter and Johanna Konta helped them see off Slovenia. Britain are in Group 1 of the Europe-Africa zone of the women's team tournament and are hoping to get to the World Group 2 playoff in April if they come out on top of the round-robin event in Bath. It has been 26 years since they played a tie in this country, and they made the perfect start by getting the point on the board in their opening Group A match as Boulter from Woodhouse Eaves and Konta put them 2-0 up in the best-of-three encounter against the Slovenians. Boulter, playing her first Fed Cup singles match, beat Kaja Juvan 6-4, 6-2 in the opening match, and then British number one Konta saw off Delila Jakupovic 7-6, 6-2 to get the tie won. Harriet Dart and Katie Swan were then able to enjoy the pressure-free doubles rubber, knowing the result did not matter, but they won 6-2, 6-2 against Juvan and Jakupovic anyway. Captain Anne Kiotherfong was delighted to get the job done easily ahead of what will be a grueling few days. She said, "I didn't really want to be sitting there in the deciding doubles on day one. Credit to Boulter and Konta, it is a much nicer situation knowing we have won, but this competition is far from completed. Physically it's tough, it's much warmer, but mentally you can't underestimate all the emotions they go through, playing in front of a home crowd for the first time. I thought Katie Boulter was brilliant, making her singles debut and winning in front of her home crowd is special. She has improved so much in the last 12 months, and I think 2019 can be really special." Boulter was pleased to get an early win on the board to set her team up. "I was a little nervous, everybody would feel like that in my position, but I had a great team around me to put me in the right place mentally," she said. "I like to think I'm someone who rises to the occasion. I didn't mind playing first too much, there's a lot of pressure to start off, but I thought I did well to start and get a win for the team. Konta's path was a little trickier after a topsy-turvy first set that lasted 16 minutes longer than the whole of Bulta's match. She saved 3 set points to take it on a tiebreak and then ran away with the match to win in straight sets. Britain are also in a group with Greece and Hungary, who won their opening day encounter 2-1. Britain were taking on Greece yesterday evening and Hungary this evening. Croatia, Turkey, Serbia and Georgia are in the other pool. Croatia got their campaign off to a winning start with a 2-1 victory over Turkey, while Serbia beat Georgia by the same scoreline. The winners of each group will play each other to determine who advances into the playoffs in April.
Bolta helps GB to victory, but Fed Cup match is mired in poor line call controversy. Leicestershire's Katie Bolter helped Great Britain make it 2 wins from 2 Fed Cup matches in Bath, but their 3-0 victory against Greece was dodged by controversial line calls. Bolter, 22, from Woodhouse Eaves, and Johanna Konta both won their singles matches, but there was questionable line calls throughout, and Konta's opponent, Maria Sakkari, condemned the line judges as the worst I have ever seen in my life. Bolter's opponent, Valentini Grammaticopolo, also suggested the home judges were not playing fair, as matter cast a shadow over what was a thrilling tie. Bolter delivered another opening win as she battled hard to triumph 6-3, 4-6, 6-3, before Konta made sure the tie was in the bag, after coming from a set down to beat Sakkari 4-6, 6-2, 6-3. Both sides were on the end of calls that looked wrong, but with no Hawkeye in operation, the players had no choice but to accept the decisions. "I'm really disappointed," Grammaticopolo said. "It's really unfair to play like this. 3 calls were in juice. You can watch it actually, and I will show her the balls were out. She deserved to win, but let's play fair. That's why we play tennis, you know, not to judge the lines. It's not about how she played, it's about fair play. If the ball was out, I accept. If the ball was in, I accept. But not if it was clearly out. It doesn't matter anymore, but if I want to lose, I want to lose nice." Bolter also had grievances, with an overruled call denying her 2 break points at the end of the second set. "There were a couple of bad calls here and there. Whether they were good or bad, I don't know," said Bolter. "There was a let that I thought wasn't called. It goes both ways." After her match, Sakkari, who is ranked 1 place higher than Konta at 38, did not hold back in her assessment of the officiating. "They are terrible," she said, "since the first round. The chair umpires are great, but the line umpires are the worst I have ever seen in my life. There were mistakes for both sides. I am not saying that they always do mistakes only for us, but of course, there are more mistakes for our side. But there were quite a lot of mistakes. I think it's very tough for all the players to play with very bad line umpires on court. We are used to playing with very good professionals, and we come here. It's a very high-level Fed Cup tie. We need to have good professionals on court." Britain were more measured in their response. GB captain Ankia Thavong, whose brother James is an ATP Tour umpire, insisted the disputed calls, which all seemed to come at crucial moments, had no impact on the outcome of the matches. "I have to be diplomatic as I can," she said. "The line calling today didn't affect the outcome of the matches. There were tight line calls. The bad line calls went both ways, and how many times do you go through a tournament without players questioning a line call? There is a lot of tension out there, and players see what they want to see. My brother is an official, so I am sympathetic to them a little more these days."
Weightlifting.
Talbot powers to GB title double. Melton weightlifter Jason Talbot rolled back the years to claim his first British powerlifting title in 15 years last weekend. Talbot travelled over to Lincolnshire to compete for national titles over 2 fronts at Stanhope Hall in Horncastle. All 3 powerlift competitions were scheduled for Saturday, with the British Bench Press Championships to follow on Sunday. But with an unexpected level of entries, 2 of the men's powerlifting weight classes were moved to the Sunday, leaving Talbot the added challenge of competing twice on the same day. First up came the powerlifting, where the Melton strongman lined up in the 93kg bodyweight masters, over 50s class, alongside the defending champion and another rival who had finished 5th in last year's World Championships. In the opening squat partnership, Talbot had 3 good attempts, following a solid 205kg with 215kg, and then finishing with a comeback best lift of 222.5 kg to trail the leader by 22.5 kg. Talbot had three further good lifts in the bench press, with successful lifts at 185, 192.5 and 197.5 kg. He said, "Before the competition, I had high hopes of breaking the British record of 205 kilograms, but the competition was so tight, I just had to make 100% sure not to fail on any lifts." Superior pressing power had given him a crucial 27.5 kilogram lead going into the deadlift finale. "This was important as my two main rivals were better at the final discipline," Talbot added, "and I was pretty tired at this stage after a very early start and a bit of a struggle to make the 93 kilogram weight limit. But I was determined to give it my all and go for the win." The first two pulls, at 200 and then 220 kg, both brought three white lights and no problems. "My third pull of 225 kg was a success, but a very hard lift, to give me a total of 645 kilograms. This meant my closest rival needed to pull 252.5 kg to take the gold away from me." Keith Blacknell made a valiant attempt as the bar left the ground fast, but the lift stalled just below the knee and the weights crashed down, making Talbot a British powerlifting champion for the first time since 2004. "It was pretty tough getting myself motivated to participate in the bench press competition, and sadly I was on my own in the age and weight class. I opened on 175 kg, failed 200 on a technicality, but then took 200 again for a good lift to win my fifth British bench press title."
You have now reached the end of the audio transcription of the back page. If you'd like to contact the Sound Services Department of Vista, please telephone 0116 249 8839 and leave a message on the answering machine. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.